Hello. Welcome to our verse-by-verse in-depth Bible study with Bible teacher Dr. Bob Utley. Now, here's Bob.
We're going to be in Esther chapters 8 through 10, finishing the book today. This is basically a discussion of the consequences of Haman's first edict and the beginning of the origins, we think, of the Feast of Purim, okay? On that day, King Ahasuerus gave the house of Haman, the enemy of the Jews, to Queen Esther. And Mordecai came before the king, for Esther had disclosed what he was to her. So the whole truth's coming out now. All the property of this prime minister, which apparently was large if he had 10,000 talents of silver to offer the king to pay for the killing of the Jews. Now, we're not sure that may have been just the plunder from the Jews being killed, but we think Haman had that much. And it was all given to Esther, including the residence where Mordecai was hanged or impaled. And the king took off his signet ring, which he had taken from Haman, and gave it to Mordecai. And Esther set Mordecai over the house of Haman. So here we have the authority of the prime minister. The king didn't want to fiddle with all that. Passed on from Haman to Mordecai because the king understood the relationship between Mordecai and Esther and that Mordecai had proved to be faithful. Now, it says Esther set Mordecai over the house. It would have been inappropriate for the queen to give away that which was just given to her by the king. So she just put Mordecai in control of it, and it was a proper residence for the new prime minister, apparently close to the palace and fancy enough to fulfill the office which he was given. Okay? And then Esther spoke again to the king and fell at his feet and wept and implored him to avert the evil scheme of Haman the Agite and his plot which he had devised against the Jews. Now, Esther was safe and Haman was gone, but the edict was still in place. Now, remember, the law of the Medes and the Persians can't be changed. Haman, with this signet ring of the king which showed his authority in his name, had sent this out all over the provinces. And come the 13th day of this certain month, all the Jews were going to be killed and their property taken over by those who killed them. And there was no way to change that. Now, what Esther is crying for, she said, oh, please change it, please change it. She doesn't seem to understand that the king can't change it even if he wants to. And so that's the idea here. Now, Haman the Agite, we've talked about that. If many commentators believe it's related to the king of the Amalekites, Agag, who Samuel hacked to pieces before the Lord. Remember the story? Saul was supposed to kill them all and take no plunder, and suddenly Samuel heard all this sheep and animals, and here came even the king himself in chains. And he said, Saul, what have you done? He said, well, we just brought it back for a sacrifice. And Samuel said, you've disobeyed, and you're going to be punished about for it. And then Samuel killed the king. Now, that is... possibly this man's origin. And yet it'd be unusual for a foreigner to be the prime minister, so maybe it's just a place name that we're not used to or some family designation that is unrelated to our Old Testament history. Then notice it said, and his plot which he had devised against the Jews, that's this edict we're talking about. And the king extended the golden scepter to Esther. Now, apparently this was a sign of welcome. Apparently it was used for more than just saving her life, or she had intruded again into his presence without being called for, and he had to hold it out to her or lest she would die. Now, which it is, we're just not certain. Multiple use of the scepter, or she again entered his presence unannounced. Then she said, if it pleases the king, and if I have found favor before him, and the matter seems proper to the king, and I am pleasing in his sight, all this court etiquette, let it be written to revoke the letters devised by Haman. She wants the thing just canceled. And he says, I can't do that. There's no way I can do that. And so Mordecai understands what's happening. So look at that in verse 7. So the king Ahasuerus said to Queen Esther and to Mordecai the Jew, behold, I have given the house of Haman to Esther, and him they have hanged on the gallows because he has stretched out his hands against the Jews. Now you write to the Jews as you see fit in the king's name and seal it with the king's signet ring, for a decree which is written in the name of the king and sealed with the king's ring may not be revoked. Now he is reminding Mordecai, we can't revoke the other one. You write another one. Now this has been the way that apparently Persian kings did it. The Bible is the only source of the information that the laws of the Medes and the Persians couldn't be changed. You could write a second law to somehow counteract or undo the first, but you could never cancel the first. And that's the predicament here. So the king's scribes were called at that time in the third month, which is the month of Sivan, be our May or June, on the 23rd day of the month. Now, the very fact that all these specific dates are mentioned through here adds to the historicity, in my opinion, of the book of Esther, as well as the eyewitness accounts of the court techniques, the architecture of the court, and these dates all tell me it's a history. Now, according to all that Mordecai commanded the Jews, the satrap, there's those big, large, there's 30 of them in the Persian Empire, large administrative districts, governors, smaller administrative districts, and then princes, the local officials. From India to Ethiopia, all right? They sent this all over to every province according to its script. They wrote in the language of the people who were there, to every people according to their language, as well as to the Jews according to their script and their language. And here's what he wrote. He wrote in the name of the king Ahasuerus, sealed it with the king's ring, and sent letters by couriers on horses riding on the steed sired by the royal stud. Now, if you have the King James, it sounds different than that. But all these couriers we know from history rode on horses. And apparently these horses were a special breed that came from the special horse the king rode. Remember, Haman wanted the man to be honored to ride on the king's special horse? Well, here's another allusion to that. And then the king granted the Jews, who were in each and every city, the right to assemble and to defend their lives. Notice, to kill, to destroy, to kill, and to annihilate the entire army of any people or province which might attack them, including children and women, and to plunder their spoil. Now, this is exactly like the Edict of Haman. As a matter of fact, the words to kill, destroy, and annihilate are those three synonyms, going so far as women and children. It's an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. Now, it may sound ugly to you, but you've never been under that kind of pressure. You've never been threatened with the destruction of your life and family. It's something of the holy war almost here in this kind of thing. Now, a copy of the edict was to be issued as law in each and every province and published to all the peoples, so that the Jews should be ready for this day to avenge themselves on their enemies. And the couriers hastened and impelled the king's command, went out riding on the royal steeds, and the decree was given out in Susa, the capital. Then Mordecai went out from the presence of the king in royal robes of blue and white. Now, there's a lot of problem with these ancient colors. My margin, the New American Standard Version, has purple and white. We're not certain the exact shades of these, but apparently a blue or a purple and white was the king's color. And so the robe, it's not the king's robe, but it's a robe of these nobles, was apparently these royal colors, and Mordecai was given one, with a large crown of gold. Now, this is not as large as the king's crown, but it was a separate word that described the crown these nobles wore, these seven special families. And that seems to be what is mentioned here. A garment of fine linen would be white. The city of Susa shouted and rejoiced. Now, because of this, I think that if we go back to chapter 3:15, that when the city heard about Haman's edict, it said they were confused, thrown into confusion. I think they were upset. They weren't basically anti-Semitic, and so they thought it was unfair, and here they rejoiced that things have been set right. The Jews, in verse 16, really rejoiced. Notice where it mentions that in verse 17, and many among the peoples of the land became Jews. Now, this either means they became full proselytes, which means the men had to be circumcised, they had to baptize themselves, and they had to offer some kind of sacrifice. Now, whether that is what's involved here, or simply it means it's a way of saying that the populace supported the Jewish cause, that seems to be more in line with what's happening. Now, in chapter 9. Now, in the 12th month, that is the month of Adar, on the 13th day, when the king's command, the edict, were about to be executed, doesn't tell us what happened in between. On that day, when the enemies of the Jews hoped to gain mastery over them, now, though Haman was dead, there were still many anti-Semites in the province who took his edict as an opportunity to rid themselves of these Jews. Apparently, the Jews had become very wealthy. They are just very good at that. They had many prominent places, and apparently it was jealousy. The Jews assembled in their cities throughout the provinces. This does not mean the cities were fully Jewish, but in every city where there was Jewish communities, the Jewish people got together for the strength of numbers, okay? And all the princes of the provinces, satraps and governors, and those who were doing the king's business assisted the Jews. Now, this probably does not mean that that the Persian army fought on behalf of the Jews. It simply means the government was favorable to the Jewish cause because Mordecai, a Jew, is the new prime minister, and they know that Esther, the queen, is Jewish. And so they went along with what was expedient for them. Thus the Jews struck all their enemies with the sword, killing and destroying, but they did not please to those... And they did what they pleased to those who hated them. And in Susa the capital, the Jews killed and destroyed 500 men. And here the next are the 10 sons of Haman are listed by name. They're listed in an unusual pattern in some Hebrew text, which may imply they were to be said all at once and then they were to pass away forever because they were an entire lineage right there. The 10 sons of Haman, but they did not lay hands on the plunder. Now there's been several theories involved. The edict said they could take the plunder of those who fought against them, but the Jews didn't do it. Now, why? Well, I think there's three possible reasons that I can ferret out. Number one, they wanted to show their motive was not greed. They did not ask for this fight. They did not look for it. They're just simply trying to cancel out the edict of an evil man, so they didn't want the plunder. Now, the fact that the plunder of those who executed under the edict of the king went to the royal treasury. Maybe they wanted to show the king that these, their enemies, were the state's enemies, and so the property of the enemies reverted to the crown. Or number three, possibly if you believe that these are descendants of Agag, they were required not to take any of their property back from the count earlier in the life of Saul. And so maybe it's related to that. We're just not sure. The king said to Esther, the Jews had killed and destroyed 500 men and the 10 sons of Haman in Susa, the capital. What then had they done in the rest of the king's provinces? The king sounds a little surprised at the number that were killed, apparently. Now, what is your petition? It shall be granted you, even, and what is your further request? It shall be done. So he says, Esther, is there anything else I can do to help you? And Esther says, yes. Then Esther said, if it pleases the king, let tomorrow also be granted to the Jews who are in Susa, to do according to the edict of today, and let Haman's 10 sons be hanged on the gallows. Now here's the idea of being publicly impaled. It's a continuing sign of shame to this family. And you say, well, boy, she's vindictive, wants another bloodbath. Well, let me say this on behalf of Esther. Number one, we don't know what the Jewish casualties were. Number two, we don't know the state of the battle in this capital city. They may be continuing to fight, and there was just a isolated pockets of resistance left that need to be cleared up. We don't know. Why hang these 10 boys? Apparently they were in cahoots with their father and they had the same attitude toward the Jews, and the only way to put a stop to this is for a public display of those who go against the Jews. And so it seems to be something that's done as a public deterrent to future anti-Semitism. And I don't think Esther's a vindictive person. We just don't know all the historical facts. So the king commanded that it should be done so, and the edict was issued at Susa, and Haman's 10 sons were, now the word's hanged here, but it should be impaled, I think. And the Jews who were in Susa assembled also in the 14th day of the month of Adar, and killed 300 men in Susa, but they did not lay hands on their plunder. So it's going to be 800 total killed in Susa in these 2 days. Verse 16. Now the rest of the Jews who were in the king's provinces assembled to defend their lives and rid themselves of their enemies, to kill 75,000 of those who hated him, but they did not lay hands on their plunder. Now this word 75,000 is a very large number. The Septuagint, which is the Greek translation of the Old Testament, has the number 15,000. And yet it is surprising that Josephus and the 5th century AD Syriac known as the Peshitta, that is based on the Septuagint, still have the number 75,000. So 75,000 seems to be original, and the Septuagint seems to be have been changed later. But we just can't be certain about how many. This was done on the 13th day of the month, Adar, and on the 14th day they rested and made it a day of feasting and rejoicing. But the Jews who were in Susa assembled on the 13th and 14th of the same month. They rested on the 15th day and made it a day of feasting. Now here we have an explanation in verses 18 and 19 of how we got a 2-day feast. Apparently the Jews in the country rested on one day, and the Jews in the capital rested on another, and they kind of settled it by having both days as a feast day. Now the rest of this discussion through here, the rabbis are going to say, well, the 13th of the month should be a fast, and the 14th and 15th a feast. So we're beginning to standardize the Feast of Purim. And I have a book here I want to show you. It's from Shocken Press, a Jewish publisher. I get several of my books from them. I don't agree with all this because I already have some problems with how the Jews think that this festival came from. The author of this says it came from Babylon. They just changed it around. I disagree with that. But this book does show the feast of the Jews and the way they were kept in different ages in different geographical settings. And so the Jewish Festivals, History and Observance, is a good book. It has a special calendar in here of the Jewish festivals that you might want to see. So this would be, not familiar with Shocken Press, write to them in New York City. They'll send you a list of their books. And there are some real good ones in here that I like very much. So we're trying to describe now the exact order and structure of the Feast of Purim. Notice in verse 22, it's going to be a time of giving gifts and of giving alms to the poor. Now, I want to tell you, giving alms to the poor was a very important work in Judaism. Some rabbis went so far as to say giving alms takes away sins. So it was very important. This was a day they made a special effort to give each other gifts and to help the poor. Thus the Jews undertook what they had started to do and what Mordecai had written to them. Apparently Mordecai writes them, and then Mordecai and Esther write them again, trying to get this feast set up to do every year exactly the same way on exactly the same dates. For Haman the son of Hammedatha the Agite, the adversary of all the Jews, had schemed against the Jews to destroy them and had cast Pur. Now Pur is an Akkadian word that means to cast the lot or one's destiny. And so we think Purim is related to Pur, this Akkadian word for lot. And the destiny of the Jews was certainly caught up in this. And when it came to the king's attention, he commanded by letter that his wicked scheme and all that he had devised, verse 25, 26, and 27, kind of a summary of what's happened in the book of Esther, okay? And so these days were to be remembered and celebrated throughout every generation, every family and every province and every city. And these days of Purim were not to fail from among the Jews or their memory fade from their descendants. This is a way of saying they're to keep on doing it every year. Now verse 29. Then Queen Esther, the daughter of Abihail, with Mordecai the Jew, wrote with full authority to confirm this second letter about Purim. This seems to be the letter. Apparently Mordecai wrote one. It kind of got set up here, but it was a little different. The country folks were doing it one way and the city folks another. And so they wrote a second letter with Mordecai's authority, with Esther's authority, and said, this is the way we're going to do it. This is the form we're going to use. It's mandatory for Jews, and don't forget it. But this letter was sent out as an official document from the Persian king, and you can read that. Verse 31, to establish these days of Purim at their appointed times. Okay? Let's see. Now, the deal about fasting and lamentations, the last of verse 31, that's where the rabbis get the idea of the 13th, the day of the slaughter, is a day of fasting and mourning. Because apparently some Jews died then too. But the next 2 days are feast days to rejoice in God's providential care and deliverance of the Jewish nation. Now, the chapter 10 only has 3 verses in it. Now, King Ahasuerus laid a tribute on the land and on the coastlands of the sea. Now, this coastlands, of course, means islands. We don't understand exactly what this means from history, for we know that the campaign against the Greeks that we talked about earlier fits beautifully into the history of Esther, because it's a 4-year period between when Vashti was deposed, almost 4 years till Esther was crowned queen. And it's hard to describe why those 4 years are there unless the 2-year Greek campaign fits in there. We know from history, especially Herodotus and others, that when Xerxes I was defeated by the Greeks, he came back and spent much more time with his harem. And that seems to be where Esther was crowned. Now, from history we also know that when the Greeks defeated the Persian army and the Persian navy, that the Persians signed a treaty they would remove their fleet from the Mediterranean Sea and they would give back all the islands of the Aegean to the Greeks. So what this islands means, we're not sure. Some think it means the islands off the coast of Europe that were garrisoned by Persian soldiers during this period and were retained. Others think that the small islands along the coast of Palestine and Egypt were just not certain. But the purpose is to show the greatness of Ahasuerus in the fact that he is going to tax a large group of lands under Mordecai's direction. Some have said, well, Mordecai was trying to show him that it's better to tax than to kill people and take their property for the royal treasury. Well, there may be a truth in that, but this does not say that. It's just trying to show the greatness of Ahasuerus and the continuing influence and predominance of Mordecai the Jew. It's funny, the book of Esther closes with the greatness of Mordecai, not the greatness of Esther. And all the accomplishments of his authority and strength, and the full account of the greatness of Mordecai, to which the king advanced him, are they not written in the book of the Chronicles of the kings of Media and Persia? Now, this is not the book of Chronicles in your Bible, of course. It says this court record. Remember, it was mentioned earlier in chapter 2, recording what Mordecai did about the attempted assassination. It's recorded in chapter 6. This is what the king who couldn't sleep because he ate too much at Esther's first banquet and had people read this to him. He remembered Mordecai and blessed him there. And here those same documents are mentioned again. For Mordecai the Jew was second only to King Ahasuerus and great among the Jews and in favor with the multitudes of his kinsmen, one who sought the good of his people and one who spoke for the welfare of the whole nation. And here's the idea that Mordecai, like Daniel, faithfully served these foreign powers, looking out for their good and trying to do the best he could. That's what Joseph did for Egypt. That's what Daniel and the three young Hebrew boys did to Babylon. And that's what Mordecai is going to do for this Persian king. And so this concludes the book of Esther. It's been a difficult story because there's not a lot of theology here. There is that trust in God that is so evident throughout, even though God's name is not mentioned. There is that wonderment about why God's not mentioned, the temple's not mentioned, the law's not mentioned, the cultic sacrificial system's not mentioned. We don't know that. We have no answer for that. This book has drawn such wide reviews from some rabbis saying it's next to the Pentateuch in importance. Some rabbis saying it's apocryphal. The Qumran community didn't even have one copy of Esther in all the fragments that we found. And we found fragments of every other Old Testament book except Esther. So it seems to be that it was not there. It's an argument from silence. Luther didn't like it later in the church. The church fought over it. Some said it should be included. Some said it shouldn't. It just caused a lot of problems. I think the reason it finally got in the canon was it provides the basis for the Feast of Purim. And that's apparently why the rabbis, after the destruction of Jerusalem in AD 70, these leaders of the Jews moved to a city called Jamnia. And in AD 90, they unofficially set the Old Testament canon. And Esther was included. And so we have it in our Bibles. The Greek translation has several additions. If you can find a Catholic translation like the Jerusalem Bible or a copy of the Apocrypha, it will have the prayers of Mordecai and the prayers of Esther, which are additions to this book. And also, all the way through the Septuagint, there are many different additions. God is mentioned quite often. Like in chapter 6, it says, God caused the king not to sleep. God would raise help from another side. All of this is in the Septuagint. If you have a chance to buy that, it'd be very helpful to you. It is, since the finding of the Dead Sea Scrolls, we understand the Septuagint is a valid Old Testament translation, and quite often sometimes records the original even better than the Masoretic text. So you might want to look at that. Well, I've enjoyed being with you. Don't forget to send a little book on the Jewish festivals. I think you'll like it. It's from Shocking Press, and they have some neat books on background to Jewish life and interpretation. One of the sources I was going to show you, Peggy, if you just pan right over there, this is the Encyclopedia Judaica. It's available in most libraries, and this is very good on Jewish sources, and this blue set right here. So if you're looking for the Feast of Purim or look up Mordecai or Esther, this will be a very helpful set for you to have. I think it's still available, And these are some backgrounds to Esther that are going to be helpful, because there are no real good commentaries out. I've enjoyed being with you. I hope it's been somewhat of a blessing to your life. I hope you see the faith of these people and apply it to the situation in which you live. Have a good day. I'll see you again next week.